On episode 332 of the Tennis Files podcast, you'll learn how to make your opponents miss with Jonathan Stokey.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey there, and welcome to another episode of the show. Really excited to have you listening into today's interview. And this one is with a returning guest, Coach Jonathan Stokey. He was last on episode 282 of the Tennis Files podcast, where we talked about how to win singles matches. And if you don't know about Jonathan, he actually hosts the Baseline Intelligence podcast, which is a fantastic show. And he is a tennis coach in Charleston, North South Carolina. He spent 14 years as both a student athlete and coach with the Duke men's tennis program. He helped Duke to two ACC championship titles in 2003 and 2006 and was also named the ACC Tournament MVP in 2006. Funny enough, we were chatting during the show, and my team, UMBC, when I played on the team, we traveled up to Duke and played them in the first round of the NCAA Tournament. But unfortunately, Jonathan had graduated the year before, so I didn't see him there. But pretty cool connection there. And Jonathan is a former All-American and two-time All-ACC pick, and was also named the ITA Carolina Region Assistant Coach of the Year. Jonathan actually became the first student athlete in program history to win the ITA National Arthur Ashe Sportsmanship and Leadership Award in 2006, while also earning the USTA Sportsmanship Award. And this show today is going to get into the concepts and the ways that you can make your opponents miss. And, you know, as we'll talk about, obviously, tennis is definitely a game of errors. So when you use these different strategies and choose them wisely, then you'll be able to make your opponents miss more, and therefore you're going to win more points and more matches. We also get into how this is applicable to doubles as well as singles, of course, and then serve technique. So a couple different ways that you can get more pop on your serve, and also the importance of recording and analyzing your play. So we'll get into all that and more, so hope you really enjoy this one. And without further ado, here is my interview with Coach Jonathan Stokey. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm here with my good friend Jonathan Stokey, and it's a pleasure to have Jonathan on again. He is a very esteemed member of the show, and he also hosts a fantastic podcast as well called the Baseline Intelligence podcast. So you should all definitely check that out. We'll have links in the show notes to this and all of the links that we mentioned. So Jonathan, how you been?
I've been good, man. It's been too long since we spoke. I think we did an episode maybe about a year ago, and my inner alarm was going off that we needed to chat again. So I'm glad we're doing it.
Yeah, you've got a pretty good inner alarm there, my friend. So yeah. I mean, first off, how's everything been with you in the tennis world and, you know, teaching and content creating and all that?
Everything's good. You know, podcast has done great this year. Good guests. I'm sure just like you leave every episode, you feel like you learned a ton. The Instagram is still exhausting. It's just the daily grind of continuing to put out content, put out tips. And then on court, I was telling you before the show, I had a bunch of players graduate and they're off in college now. So I've been doing more adult camp type things. And I actually love it. I love coaching adults because they're very into it. You want to get better, and that's the best type of person to teach, is someone who's just dying to improve. So have been busy in every area, but as always, we'll make an hour of time for you any day of the week.
Thanks again, my friend. And yeah, curious with the adults, I mean, what's maybe like one big overarching concept that you've been working on with them to improve? Because that's, you know, that's our main audience. So yeah,
I would say, I mean, every player, whether they're doing singles or doubles, they all have their own technical issues or tactical issues. The biggest concept that I find myself discussing with every single adult is it takes, like, think in hundreds instead of ones. It's not going to take you one lesson or one rep to improve your serve or to improve the way you play the Australian formation in doubles. It's going to take hundreds of reps. And that doesn't always have to be with a coach. You don't have to pay for that all the time. But just how long and how many reps it takes to truly improve. A lot of them will work on something and 5 minutes in, it's not going great and they're panicking. And you're like, whoa, this is going to take a while. You know, that's why improvement is difficult. And so everybody struggles with that. They want that instant gratification. They get the information. They think they should apply it right away. And so a big part of those lessons is just trying to let them know, hey, it's normal. It's normal to suck at first. It's normal to improve slowly. But if you make those tiny improvements over a substantial period of time, you're going to get where you want to go for sure. It's just going to be longer than you want.
Yeah, yeah. Well put, Jonathan. I frequently think about the image of the two individuals like who are like digging, and you know, there's the one who is like turning back after, and you see like, you know, 1 inch left until the diamonds, and then the other one's that's still going there. So yeah, that's really big. And yeah, a lot of times it's tough for coaches, you know, because you get these questions from students asking like, oh, like how long will it take for me to get this change, you know, fixed? And I guess it varies among, you know, individuals and type of change you're making and whatnot, right?
I just released an episode I recorded a couple months ago, Dr. John Finn. So he wrote a book called The Habit Mechanic. And I was asking him like, well, how long does it take to reprogram a bad habit? And he was like, well, 21 days is a bunch of BS. He's like, if you've been engaging in negative self-talk for 3 years, you're not going to get rid of that habit in 3 weeks. That's going to take you a long time. And if you've only been doing something poorly for a month, then maybe it only takes a month to get rid of that. So depending on what it is, if it's just a technical motion, but someone's been making the wrong forehand stroke for 5 years, I don't think you're going to get significant improvement in 2 or 3 weeks. Like that's just not going to happen. But if it's just a quick mindset shift, you just started playing, you've only been thinking about the game for a month or two, that stuff could happen quickly. So it's all player specific. But again, I know how I am with my own game or with my golf game. I want things to happen quickly. And very rarely does someone improve faster than they think they should because their expectations are so incredibly high.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of negative self-talk, you reminded me about, I think it was Jeff Salzenstein, and I wish I could remember which expert he was quoting, but he said something to the effect of like, verbalized negative self-talk is like 10 times more powerful than, you know, a verbalized like positive phrase, something like that. So that was pretty crazy. But did you ever have any issues with negative self-talk like when you were a player? You're still a player, but you know, younger.
Yeah, well, I'm not a player anymore. By the way, I listened to that episode with Jeff. It was awesome. And I do remember that there was, you know, something like a negative thought was 6-1, I think. And then if you said it out loud, it was 10-1, which I found super fascinating. For me, I'm not a very emotional person. So it was easier for me once I was over about the age of 13 or 14 to not engage in negative self-talk because there's so much information out there that shows that it's, you know, anti-improvement, you're not going to perform as well. And I'm like, okay, well, that makes sense. So why would I do something that's not going to help me? And then, you know, let's say I play a bad set. I've got a problem now. Like I'm not playing well and I'm down a set. If I start talking negatively to myself, now I've got two problems. Like why do I want to add issues to what's going on? I want to eliminate issues. So my attitude, I can control it. I go, cool, that's never going to be a problem for me in a match. My forehand might be an issue. My conditioning might be an issue, but something that I can easily control, I'm not going to let that be my downfall. So like I said, I know it's easier for me. That's a very pragmatic way of looking at it, but I've never understood, you know, when someone misses a ball and then throws the racket, I'm like, you lost the point and now you have a cracked racket. Like nothing got fixed by throwing that racket. You know what I mean? And so just looking at it pragmatically like that and realizing I just want to take actions that help my own game or help my students' games, it makes it pretty simple to not engage in negative self-talk.
Yeah, 100%, Jonathan. I've been reading this book called Awareness by Anthony DeMello. I think I posted it like once or twice on IG. But yeah, you know, it talks about how, you know, we're responsible for our own reactions. You know, it's like there's a stimulus put out there, right? But then it's up to you. Like, you know, you can feel bad about it or you can, you know, take it a different way and feel positive. So it's really like your fault, you know, in a sense, like for your reaction, you're responsible for it. So, yeah, I mean, so what do you, when you're coaching your students and like, and you hear the negative self-talk pop up, like what's your approach to, you know, helping with that?
So the number one thing that I find leads to that negative self-talk is like expectations that are out of whack. So they think they should serve 75%. Okay, well, if that's what you think is going to happen on your first serve, then you're going to think you stink every day. Like, I can understand why you would be frustrated. Or if you thought you were never going to miss a forehand, I got news for you. It's probably going to happen in like the first 5 points. So you're already going to be going, what's going on? So a big thing is getting them to understand the percentages, getting them to know what amount of missing is normal, what amount of winners are normal, and so that their expectations are aligned with reality. That's number one. And then number two is we just, like, honestly, we might go for a couple of weeks with players who have a hard time with it. We might say, you can still be as negative as you want. It's just every time you win a point, you have to do something positive. Let's just start balancing it out. Let's just go there. Like, you don't have to eliminate negative, but you have to do both for a while. And they'll do both. And after a while, they start getting tired because after every point, you're doing something. It's like exhausting. It's exhausting.
Yes,
to pump your fist and scream. It's like, and they eventually just get to the point where they're kind of like a baby who's been crying for a while. They're like, it's just easier to do nothing. And you go, awesome. That's great. Nothing is fine. And then over time, eventually, hopefully they're seeing the benefits of being positive. So it was funny. We had a story at Duke. This was like 10 years ago. And obviously energy in doubles is a massive thing. And so we're always talking to our guys, hey, you know, jog in and out of points, pump your fist, say, come on a couple times, like get yourself going. And this team was down 5-0 in practice. It was like an inner squad scrimmage. They're down 5-0 and their energy was really poor. And I'm like, man, you know, we got to pick that up. Like that's the number one thing before tennis. And they're like, oh, Stokey, it's not about that. Like we're serving bad. I'm like, okay, but you have this controllable thing that you could do. And they, typical 19 to 22 year old guys, they got super sarcastic with it. And started screaming, come on, like so, like just being like so over the top. And they came back and won 7-5.
Oh, wow.
And at like 5-3, at like 5-3, I could see one of them kind of give me a look like, damn, like he's kind of right about this a little bit. Like they were totally doing it just to rub it in my face. And they actually started playing better. They had more energy. And so I think everybody has that little light bulb moment where they go, man, if I fuel myself with really positive thoughts, it's impossible to hurt my own game. And it's very, very likely I'll perform closer to my best. So why not do it? But yeah, just to answer your question again, the initial part is we have them do both. We just say add positive, and then we find that eventually they kind of remove the negativity on their own.
Yeah, that's really nice. Great stuff. And yeah, that approach I actually haven't heard of before. So that's amazing. Yeah, you reminded me of a story. One of my teammates, this is another college tennis story, John from Brazil. He played in like an American University Invitational back when they had a team. We all, well, you know, the whole team played it. But like, I remember he was playing like really well against like some player from American, and like he was getting like so amped up. It was like ridiculous, you know, like just like getting to 1-0 against the guy, like yelling come ons everywhere. And then he was like completely exhausted, and then he lost like 3-1 or something like that. So I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, as you kind of mentioned, is there like a balance, like you kind of have to know like how much is too much, like when you're giving the emotions out there?
I think just like anything, it's so personal. So yeah. I'm super stoic. I was super calm. You know, if I ever hit an incredible shot on an important point, I would maybe like shake my racket. Oh, like wow. That was the extent of the positive emotion you're going to get from me. I don't know that I ever said, come on, out loud.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. If I could go back in time, that's something I would probably do a little differently. I'd do a little bit more, but I'm never going to be Rafa, you know? And actually, I spoke to Rajiv Ram 2 days ago. I'll be releasing his episode in a week or two, but Sweet. He was telling me, because growing up, we were both super quiet. And now I see him in these matches. I watched him at the Open this year, and he's like going nuts.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, I had a hard time, but I realized I play a little better, but he's like, my partner plays a lot better when I'm really fired up. So he's like, I just learned to get out of my comfort zone. I did it for a couple months. Now it's not that big a deal for me, and everybody plays better. So it's just like a muscle. You can get it stronger. If you do it more, you get less tired, but there is some type of individual personality trait that could, you know, maybe limit, are you going to be a Rafa, or are you going to be like a little bit more of like a calmer, like a sinner type person?
Right. Awesome. And then also kind of building upon another point you made earlier, you know, errors. And, you know, as a lot of us know, like with Craig O'Shaughnessy's data, it's like, what is it? 77% of points and in errors. And we should be knowing that, you know, before we get frustrated with missing a couple forehands. But, you know, you made a really nice Instagram post, and, you know, we'll link to that as well. But like about making people miss, basically producing errors. And so there's different, you know, ways you can do that, obviously. So I thought maybe we would kind of talk more in depth than Instagram will allow, generally mm-hmm. speaking, for those posts. So, yeah, I mean, maybe tell us about, you know, some of these different strategies, and then we can kind of delve deeper into them.
So Craig is famous. He kind of listed 8 ways to make an error. And I always simplify that to even 5 more for kind of like my super recreational amateur players. So he talks about using your pace, which could be fast or slow. He talks about using direction, you know, moving someone off the court, or honestly hitting down the middle too and jamming someone, but the direction of the ball, hitting deep. So depth. So you could either hit deep or short. You can mess with the height, right? You can hit very high or very low, and then you can mess with the spin. You can be mixing the spins, adding a ton of spin, taking spin off. Those are 5 very simple ways that he has described, which is great, where if you can do one of those, that's awesome. If you can do 2 at the same time, you might be able to get a short ball. If you can do 3 of those things at the same time, you might generate an error, right? Mm-hmm. And super simple way of looking at it. What I find is, if I ask any player, I'll list those out and I'll say, which 2 do you use or do you like to use? They will mm-hmm. always say pace and angle.
Oh, really? Oh, always. Not me. Not me. Oh,
good. Well, that's because you're smart, because you've been hosting a podcast for a couple of years.
Yeah.
They'll all go, oh, you know, I hit pretty fast and I can run them off the court. And like, you will hit more winners that way for sure, using pace mm-hmm. and using angle. But also, that's the riskiest for you.
Yeah.
You know, if I said $1 million, can you make a forehand? I guarantee you wouldn't hit it fast. You'd hit it slow, because you know you make more balls when you hit slower, and you would probably aim more to the middle. So those 2 are good ways to make someone miss. Generally speaking, I use those 2 as my last for players. I go, let's hit high with spin and deep.
That's mine.
Realize, yeah, you're going to be consistent, which, by the way, is one of his other ways to just making balls will make people miss. But high, heavy, deep is unbeatable. It's very difficult to hit high, heavy, and deep all the time. That's why you don't see people doing it. But that's a great goal, where not only will you be consistent yourself, but that's a challenging ball that your opponent will miss or give you a short ball. And then when it's short, you can use a little pace, you can use a little direction, and it's less risky.
Yeah, love that. Love that. So yeah, as I mentioned, you know, for me, I like spin and depth the most. Yeah. And so I guess, is that what you would also recommend for amateurs? Like, are there a couple combos that are like the easiest, you know, for them, like, you know, 3 out of 4 or 5?
Yeah, I would definitely. Yeah. It's funny, because I would say 99% of what I coach, I would coach the number one guy at Duke that I had, who at one point was number one in the country, great player. Mm-hmm. And the same way I coach a 3-0 adult. Like, to me, it's all like all these issues, the issues that I hear from a 3-0, the mindset, the struggle with tactics, is the same conversations I had with guys at Duke. And I know people don't, you know, it's like I said, 99%, there's 1% that's a little different, but like, most of the stuff carries over. We talked about this at Duke, like, hit high, heavy. We didn't tell guys just rip the hell out of the ball and let's go for incredible angle. Like, we have to do so much. A lot of times it was like, hey, let's play simple. Let's play discipline. Let's hit high, heavy, and deep. And that guy on the other side of the net is dying to lose to you. He's going to do stupid shots. He's going to get undisciplined. He's going to get tight. He's going to do all these things, because every player I've ever coached does those things. And some of them do it a lot, and some of them only do it a little bit. And so, yeah, if I'm coaching a 3-0 or an adult, I'm going, hey, high, deep, with some spin. And by the way, if you don't hit it deep, it's all good. Like, they're not going to hit a winner. They're not, they don't, that's why O'Shaughnessy says, what, 25% winners divided by 2 players. It's just not a way to lose a match. And so once you kind of accept that and you get very, very simple, is when you make your biggest gains as a player.
Gotcha. And then, yeah, I mean, in terms of, you know, directions, I know you said, obviously, we don't want to like go for extremes, but like, do you have any preference in terms of where we're directing the ball to?
Yeah. So, you know, Craig's famous for breaking up the court into A, B, C, and D. A is the outer half of the deuce. B is the inner half of the deuce. C is the inner half of the ad. D is the wider half of the ad. So generally speaking, we'll do some drills for people to help them understand, but we all have big egos as tennis players. So we all make this subconscious assumption that we're going to hit the ball where we aim. And we don't. And we know that because Novak hits 30 balls in the net every match. And I'm guaranteeing you, he wasn't aiming in the net, which means Novak Djokovic hits lower than he thinks, whatever, 20, 30 times a match. And he hits wider than he thinks 10, 15 times a match, right? And we're not Novak. So think about what we do. So A, B, C, and D, I want to say they're 6 3/4 feet wide. And so we'll just feed balls to people and say, hey, can you hit it in letter B 5 times in a row? And most of the time they can't. They'll accidentally hit an A or they're accidentally hitting C. So what I like people to do is to aim for B and C. Mm. You can aim on the outer edge of that if you'd like. That's fine, depending on the ball. And what will happen is you'll hit B and C sometimes. You'll accidentally hit into A or D sometimes. And by the way, hitting to A and D is awesome. That's great. I like it when it's an accident. Because if you're aiming at A and you pull it, now you've missed a ball wide and that point is over. If I aim to B and I hit it in B, I'm alive. It's a great shot. If I pull it and hit it to A, wow, that's even better. If I catch it late and hit it to C, I'm still alive. Like I've got three good options there if I'm aiming to B and C. And I think especially at the lower levels, we know control is not great. So just because you say you're aiming down the middle of the court, I've watched warmups. That ball's going everywhere. But so people always go, well, I don't want to hit to B and C. I don't want to just hit down the middle. And I always say, don't worry about it. You're not going to hit it there. Like your control's not that. You're going to hit it everywhere, but it'll be a more efficient, higher percentage way to play. So I'm a big, big B and C guy.
Love that. And then in terms of the spin, I mean, you know, obviously we have our strengths and weaknesses and whatnot. Like, how do you like to... You like players to like vary it quite a bit, like hit some spin, hit some top spin, hit some slice, all that. Or, I mean, what are any other thoughts on that particular category?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge advantage if you have a slice that you like, that you can rely on, whether that's a forehand or a backhand. You know, the heavier you can hit your topspin ground strokes with, that's great. Not only will the ball bounce up, it'll weigh way more on your opponent's string, which gets some errors or some short balls. But yeah, a lot of times, if you vary anything, it can work out very well for you. So one thing at Duke we used to do all the time was two fast, one slow. We'd hit two normal ground strokes and then on purpose hit a slower one. And I can't tell you how often people would miss the slow ball. And if you go two topspin, one slice, that's an issue. You know, if you go two wide, one middle. So any variation like that where you keep your opponent guessing is good. But again, you have to have the tools to do it. So if you don't have a slice, you can't vary spins in a match. Like that's just not going to happen. And if you don't have good racket speed and a closed racket face, you're not going to be able to get a ton of topspin. So just working on that. But yeah, any type of variation I've found works very, very well.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. And, you know, trying to apply this to the doubles game, is there any other, you know, differences in particular with that we should kind of be aware of with respect to the, you know, the five, you know, categories?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in doubles, what you can also do in addition to how you hit the ball is just your positioning. So, you know, I always feel like you can control in doubles a little bit more what your opponents do. So let's say I was playing you and I'm at the net, my partner is serving. So you're already smiling. I like that. You're visualizing this. So I'm at the net, my partner is serving, you're returning, and we're in regular formation in the deuce court. Okay. First point of the match, where are you going to go?
Cross court.
Exactly. I would assume you go, oh, maybe Stokey can still volley. By the way, cross court, higher percentage, whatever. You're going cross. I know that. Now, what happens if we start the match and I go Australian to start? You still going to go cross court?
No.
Exactly. So I'm telling you where I want you to return with my positioning. If I want you to return line, I go Aussie and I go, he doesn't want to hit the ball to me. So now I've got you hitting the return that I want you to hit, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one concept, but also just how much of the middle you decide to cover. I can try to tempt you into lower percentage plays. Yeah. If I coach a lot, I've got you thinking about me. So I always, you know, whatever, you can lie to yourself. I think it's true, but I also would lie to myself a little bit. If I'm active up there, every time the baseliner missed, I'm like, that's because of me. Like I did that, you know, like
for sure.
he took his eye off the ball. He was thinking about me. He might not have been. But it definitely gives me the courage and the motivation to continue being active and doing things up there. But yeah, I always felt like I could talk people into low percentage shots just by positioning myself in the high percentage area, realizing they probably don't want to hit to me at the net. So now I've got them trying risky things, which they'll pull off sometimes, but not enough to win the match. I'll end up winning for that. So yeah, I would say doubles positioning is a great way to make people miss for free.
Definitely, man. I mean, when I'm at the baseline in doubles and I'm hitting against a high level net player, like I can like feel and even like slightly kind of see them like moving. It's not great. You know, then you last minute, you're like, oh, I really got to, you know, pull this a little wider. And then, you'll miss sometimes. And then also on the return, you know, that's the number one, you know, problem. Like my partner will tell me like, oh, I was distracted by the net player. And you know, that will happen to me too. Sometimes I'll try to remember to try to pick my spot, you know, and just go for it. Like when I'm returning, otherwise you're going to get distracted by the net player.
The flip side though, if I was the baseliner and you were super active at the net before the point, I might talk to my partner and go, hey, I'm going down the line, 'cause he's moving all the time. Fine. You make your decision, but I would also be careful to assume that that person's going to hit a volley winner. Mm. So you get distracted by the net player. You know, look, if he poaches on me, that means he gets a volley. He's still got to put it away.
Yeah.
Like that's not easy. That's if true. He comes back to my side, I'm going to get it. If he goes to my partner, like they have a chance at a reflex, or maybe I can track that ball down behind him. But there's always this assumption that if that net player gets the ball, they're going to hit a winner. And so people go for more and they miss. And so that's why when you're at the net, use that to your advantage. But if you're at the baseline, just go, it's okay if they hit a winner. They'll do it sometimes, but just because they get the volley doesn't mean the point's over, and that will help you be more solid from the baseline.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Jonathan. I mean, better to, you know, get it back, hit your spot that you wanted, rather than like now you're going for like a super low percentage shot like we talked about with the directions, and then you just don't even have a chance because you hit it out.
Right.
So, yeah, that makes sense. Did you use a lot of let's see, eye formation in college as well?
Yeah, so we did. If you watch guys now, they do like Rajiv and I used to call that semi-eye. But sometimes when people go eye formation, they kind of like straddle or split the center service line. And what you'll watch a lot of pros do, I've seen every pro team do this, is they go eye formation, but they're kind of slanted towards the side they're serving to. So they might be like a yard off the center. If they're serving to the ad court, they'll be eye formation right of that center line. And that's just because you're covering everything from there. If you're in the center of the court, you're actually leaving too much of the down line open. So we used to do semi-eye a lot. We would do regular, a fair amount on second serves, especially when we served body. And then almost never use Aussie as a player. As a coach, we used it a lot. So I'll give you one example of formations and kind of how we used it. It's interesting. In college, so you play a 6-game set with no ad. So let's just say that the match goes to a tiebreaker. So it's 12 games. That means everybody serves, what am I? What's 12 divided by 4? 3? Everybody serves 3 games, right?
Yeah.
And so no ad, like the most a returner can play per game is 4 points. So that means against each server, the maximum you could do is return 12 points. That's not a big sample size, right? Yeah. So we had a guy with a stress fracture in his right hand. So he could hit backhands. He could not hit forehands. He could only slice it. And so in the deuce court, we would do 3 things. And it was basically all the same. It just looked different. So we would go regular formation. He was serving. And we would have the net guy poach. And my guy would cover line. So if the returner went down the line, he was right-handed from the deuce side. He would hit a running backhand. Great. He can hit a backhand. Or the net guy got the ball in the poach. Then we would do eye, and we would do eye right. And so, again, the net guy either got the volley or they returned down the line and my guy got a backhand. Or we would do Australian, right? And it's the same thing. They go down the line, backhand. So we gave them 3 different looks to start the point.
Right.
To accomplish the same thing. We either want the net guy getting the ball or my guy hitting a backhand. And when it's only 12, 15 points, you're like, they didn't catch on because they missed a return. And, you know, one time they lobbed and it's like, then it was another 15 minutes before that guy served again. And you're just doing the same. You're accomplishing the same thing with just a different look. So
yeah, smart.
I find most people just do regular because it's simple and they've always done it. And that's not really the best reason to pick a formation. If you can learn how to do all 3, if someone's not comfortable with Australian, that's a huge advantage for you. I'd love to play a game that I know the rules to and you don't.
Yeah.
So if I know how to play down the line and poaching and all that, and you've never done it, why would I go regular? You know, I want something you're uncomfortable with. So I would absolutely recommend for everybody to get really good at all 3 and then figure out based on your opponent, which one you think might be the most effective.
Yeah. Great stuff. The one that I probably have done the least is like Australian, but then the net player like goes back and like poaches. Have you ever done that?
Yeah. So the Australian guy would then go back to normal.
Yeah.
He would only be poaching regular. Yeah. So the biggest thing is when they go Australian, let's say that we'll use the deuce court example, right? So the net person would be standing on the right side of the center service line, the server and the net person on the same side of the court. Even though that net person is technically covering the right half, they should be moving left after the serve because they're over covering the cross court. So even though they still are responsible for that half, you're always moving towards the side that's serving and you're pinching off that down the line. And then that's a really difficult cross court angle return to get by them and by their, the returner's partner's head as well. So yeah, I mean, you could poach from there. That's a lot going on. I think it's tough to get that down the line return if you're poaching from Australian.
There's distance, yeah.
Yeah, but the biggest thing is that you're always still pinching it to the side that you serve to, right? Got and so it. That's a mistake people make is they stand way far over and you're just out of the point. Like you have you have forced them to go down the line, but you're not doing anything up there. You want to make sure you're at a minimum straddling the center service line after the serve, if not on the same side of the court as the serve.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Got it. And just to reiterate, I really love the semi-eye. Like, I don't think I see anybody, straddle the same side. Or, if you're serving, if the server's on the ad side and then you do the eye, like you said that the partner should be like covering like a little bit to the right, right?
Correct. They should be, at most, like we would tell, let's say the ad court example you had, some guys who were pretty athletic, I would say you can put your left foot on the center service line.
Yeah. Okay.
And then your right foot would be 2 or 3 feet to the right of it. Yeah. So you're shading towards the side you're serving to.
Yeah.
It's still probably over covering the cross court. But my geniuses at Duke, sometimes if you didn't tell them exactly what to step on, they couldn't do it. So
there's a lot. You guys are supposed to be smart over there.
Exactly. I mean, hey, I went there too. We're not all smart, man. But so say, hey, just stand there, and that's a good starting point. But yeah, you very rarely see someone just put both feet on the center line and crouch down or just straddle it. It's just you're out of play for that down the line return.
Gotcha. I think I've asked you about Joey Addis, right? Like, were you there when he was at Duke?
Yeah, we were all American together my senior year.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sick. That's awesome. Yeah, I remember my senior year, 2007, our UMBC, we made NCAAs because we won our conference and we played you all. We went up to your university and like.
So it was 1 year really after nice. That was the year after I graduated. So I just missed you.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's funny, man. But yeah, it's really nice university. Awesome doubles talk. It's singles as well. So like for the server, what's your approach like to serving? I mean, yeah, just generally speaking, like, you know, you assess your opponents, like, how do you choose like where to serve
For singles or doubles?
Oh, sorry. For doubles.
So of course you have your own strengths. So I know what serves I like. I know what serves I don't like. A big part is I need to know what volleys my net player wants on my team. So do they, they have a horrible backhand volley. Okay. Well then we need to design serves that get people to hit cross court. Cause if they go down the line, that's going to be a backhand volley. My guy doesn't like that. So that's one thing. We used to do a ton of body serves, backhand body. We would either go eye backhand body left, or we would do regular backhand body left. And we just wanted to jam people up, get them falling off the court a little bit. They would pull a backhand down the line to our net player, which was great. And then our net player would volley down the middle. And that was something that was repeatable on a no ad point, body serve, high percentage. Jam them up so they couldn't hit that fast. It was kind of sliding and crossing from one hip to the other. So they didn't really know, do I have to hit a forehand or a backhand? That was always a top play for us in the deuce court. Generally speaking, you know, if you are limited and you go, man, I've got a great T serve and I don't have much else. Okay, then that I would use your best serve as often as possible and then set up the formations and your poach calls to kind of work off that. But hopefully you have more than one option. That's obviously going to help you hold. But yeah, we did a lot of body. First serves in play are huge. In doubles, when you hit a weak second serve, your partner at the net is just a sitting duck. So you go up trying to hit aces and trying to hit bombs, and half the time that person's sitting up there, they're not going to like when you serve. So high percentage, bodies are good, jam them up. And then another tip in terms of reading it, and of course the serve has to be effective, is I found whatever way the returner was leaning is usually where the ball tended to go. So if I hit a very good serve out wide and they were falling outside of the doubles alley,
yeah,
the ball usually went down the line on the return.
Yeah, so hard to pull across.
Right? And if I served in the T and they were falling towards the middle of the court, that backhand return would go inside out cross court because that's the side they were falling. If I went the serve I was telling you about, slice body, backhand body,
yeah,
they're kind of falling outside the doubles alley and they ended up pulling that return down the line quite a bit because that's the way they were moving to hit the ball. So that's kind of how we would call plays is I'm going to hit a serve, visualize which way the returner will have to move. And generally speaking, that's where we want our net player to be going because we think the return is most likely to go there.
Got it. Got it. Jeez, a lot of pressure for the returner here. What do we do as a returner? Any tips against all this movement and, you know, these crazy serves of yours?
Yeah, I'm about to make a ton of enemies because everybody I know says they hate this. But I played a match against UNC one time and they went back and watched the video and Sam Paul told me I slice lobbed them 38 times in a pro set.
Boom. Hell yeah. I love that so play.
I would sit on my backhand. I had a weak forehand. I would sit on my backhand grip. And if you served there, I would annihilate it. If they served to my forehand, I would just hit this little bunt chip lob over the backhand volley of the net guy. And I'd come to the net. And I liked the chip lob because I didn't have to worry about the net guy. If he's poaching, if he's staying, it doesn't matter. If the lob's over his head, I did my job. Also, I knew I could make it. So I'm putting a return in play.
Yeah.
So that's one like very brain dead way. I don't have to worry about the net guy. I'm going over him. He's irrelevant. I just have to make sure I can execute that shot. One great player I played with, Philip King. He was a four-time All-American. He won Kalamazoo twice. And he was an insane returner. Top 10 player in college, top 10 doubles player. And he would just rip over the net strap. That was his first serve return target. I played 25 matches with him about that. And every single first serve return, he said net strap. Every point. And he would rip it. He would rip it. And just like we were talking earlier with your targets, he didn't hit it over the net strap every time. Sometimes he caught it early and it was an amazing cross court return. Sometimes he caught it late and he was jamming the guy at the net or it wasn't, but he made a lot of returns. It was very simple. He didn't worry about what the guy was doing. He just picked his spot and let it rip. And that's definitely good advice, I'm sure, as well.
Dude, that's awesome. Yeah. Wow. I guess it's funny. I do the opposite of what you do in terms of the return, but same idea. Like, you know, my forehand's much stronger than my backhand. So especially on days where I'm not feeling, you know, the backhand topspin return or flat, you know, I'll just like chip that backhand over the net player. So it neutralizes and it's a good play.
Yeah. Good. Returns in play are huge. And obviously, like I said, if you can hit a good lob, you're in business. And I said, I'd make a lot of enemies because most adults I coach go, I hate when people lob.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, well, to me, that just exposes something you're not great at because I would love if people lobbed me. I still have a good overhead. That's great. If you want to lob me every time, I'll take that. So if you don't like when people lob, you either don't like overheads or you don't like high bouncing balls deep on the baseline and you need to work on that. And I guarantee if you're good at it, they'll stop lobbing you. Like they lob you because it's working, right?
Yeah.
So, that's always a telltale sign of like you get exposed for something you don't like is when you go, man, I hate that style of play. Generally speaking, you're probably not beating that guy 0-0 if you hate their style of play.
Yeah. Now you know what you got to work on. I helped teach a clinic with Gigi Fernandez and Peter Freeman and a bunch of people like, it was this past year. With the adults that we had, they were amazing. Maybe like 3-0 to 4-0 for the most part. But yeah, like when we did the overhead drills, like they just hated it. Like they were really struggling. So it's really a great play. Then you're not going to get punished too much until you get, 4-5-5-0 level usually. So Yeah, amazing stuff. In terms of, you know, I want to get onto a topic that I've, you know, me and a lot of players struggle with a lot, serve technique. So I was wondering, like, you know, especially based off any recent, you know, instructions you've been given, like any major, you know, I guess flaws in technique that are really robbing players of power that you know, you can identify for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing new, but, you know, Vic Braden's information and research on the toss, the height of the toss is always huge. I start there with a lot of people. We want it first serve. You're talking about pace, so hopefully we're not doing second serves. But serve, the toss is out in front a little bit. It's out to the right side a little bit if you're a right-hander. It's out to the left side a little bit if you're a left-hander. So, yeah, and you only need to toss a little higher than you can reach. Most people just launch the toss. And so, again, most people, I do a good job of, you know, explaining that, and they kind of buy into it. But, you know, if someone lobbed you and hit a lob as high as they could, and I said, take that overhead out of the air. It's extremely difficult because the ball is dropping really quickly, right? You would definitely want to let that ball bounce.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's dropping faster and it's a much smaller scale. But if you launch your toss, the ball is dropping quickly and it's much more difficult to hit the ball clean. And the reason why people toss high is because they've always done it, or some people think you're supposed to. And then when they toss high, they develop these hitches and these hesitations. Yeah. And then they feel like they need to toss high because that's their favorite motion. When they throw a ball, when they throw a racket in a field, no one hesitates.
Yeah, so, I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, so you know instinctively, man, I want to throw this fast. Let me just go continuous motion. And then, but all of a sudden when you serve, you're supposed to have this like huge pause. Like that doesn't, it doesn't really add up and it doesn't make sense. So that's always the first thing, is just getting the toss in a spot where you can swing fast and you can time it. So you're hitting the sweet spot, which ultimately will lead to more speed.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Yeah, because I mean, kind of a strange example, but I was playing like dodgeball with my friends a couple weeks ago. It was super fun, and I was just like throwing these belters, just like nailing my friends and some young kids. Maybe I shouldn't have said that on the podcast, but you know, the brawls don't hurt that much. But yeah, you know, just like throwing rockets, and then like, you know, when I'm up to serve, like I feel like there's still more potential, power potential there. So yeah, I think a lot of that does have to do with like the toss height and whatnot, just making you kind of hesitate, hang out there for a while. So yeah.
Andy Fitzell said it best too. We were talking about that on a pod from like 6 months ago. And if you're used to taking a pause and then you start tossing at what I would call the optimal height, so it's a lower toss than what you were used to, you're gonna feel insanely rushed at first.
Yeah.
Like that, of course, you have less time than you're used to. Give it a week or two. Like I've been doing that now. I don't serve much, but when I teach, I practice this motion. I toss much lower than I used to as a player. And it feels like the most natural thing in the world. So yeah, if you do it at first, you go, man, this feels bad. It feels rushed. Yeah, I get it. Like you probably have, you know, half a second less time compared to what you're used to. You're going to have to speed everything up, which is unnatural at first. Give it some time though, and I guarantee you'll hit it a little cleaner, a little more consistently.
Sweet. Awesome. Awesome. Is there maybe another power source that you see, you know?
I mean, Dr. Kovacs talks about, Mark Kovacs, he talks about, you know, using the back leg. That's a big thing. You know, obviously palm down, people talk about that quite a bit. You know, a lot of people have a palm up, waiter's tray. To me, that's a big change though. I find most people aren't willing to go from palm up to palm down, and you go, here's all the work you're going to have to put in. Here's all the time. And here's all the really awful serves you're going to hit before it gets good. Most people are like, I'm not into that. So they want more power, and you go, here's an option. And then they're like, nah, I don't like that option. So, you know, using your legs more for sure, trying to keep the toss more continuous. The palm down one is a great thing, but that's major surgery for some people. And that's a big, big fix, a big time commitment. And a big repetition commitment.
Yeah, for sure. It's tough. So when you were preparing for matches, Jonathan, I was wondering if you could maybe like walk me through like what type of routine did you have? And then, you know, maybe if you, let's say, aren't totally pleased with like that routine, like how would you improve that?
Like, are you saying like leading up to the match, like the day of?
Yeah.
So like when I was a player, I used to get incredibly nervous. I know everybody does, and they think it's specific to them. Everyone out there is getting nervous, just whatever. I could barely eat when I was younger. As I got older, like it was fine. But like when I was 14, it was like, man, eating breakfast is going to be tough today. Like I got a big match. So whatever, I would eat 2 hours before. I'd warm up usually well before. I didn't like to go right on the court. So my warm up would be 20 minutes. It's not practice. Like my coach used to always say, the hay's in the barn, man. Like you got what you got. You hitting for 45 minutes in the warm up isn't going to fix whatever issue you may have on that day. So get loose, keep it simple. I would warm up very slow. I'd hit medium speed. I would just get a lot of balls in play. Same routine, you know, whatever, middle, cross, couple volleys, couple serves and returns. I would try a bunch of drop volleys at the end just because I liked the shot, and that would kind of relax me. And then leading into the match, I would just be very kind of quiet off by myself. Back then, we didn't have, you know, you had like the Walkman. So you had to put like, you had to put like a CD in like an actual thing, and it was like a nightmare. So it's not like I listened to a ton of music, but I was just always, I always wanted to make sure I knew exactly what I do. I would be going over it constantly in my head, like I said, because I was a psycho and I was super nervous. But hey, what's my best serve? Hey, what are my best plays? Hey, what do I want to do on return? Just on a loop over and over and over and over again. So I was like, this is what I want to do. And then when I would get on the court, then it would be easier for me to focus on my opponent because there was no chance I was going to fail at what I was doing. I already had that locked down. Yeah. I was already super focused, so I could spend a little more time on them. But I just try to keep it the same. And then, like you said, you know, what if the warm up or what if the routine didn't go well? Sure, there are some things with rain or whatever, and you got to be flexible. The big thing I always reminded myself is a good warm up does not mean a good match, and a bad warm up does not mean a bad match. So if you've ever played a good set against someone, have you ever followed that up with a bad set? Okay, well, that's the same person on the same court, like 1 minute apart. Now think you warmed up an hour and a half before. You don't think things can change. So I used to always just treat it like, hey, I'm getting my body loose, not particularly concerned how the ball feels, because I'm going to be using new balls with a different opponent, different pressure, different temperature in 2 hours. None of the warm up really means a whole lot in terms of result.
Right. Yeah. Just get the body ready. Yeah, that makes sense. And then kind of conversely, you know, your post-match routine. I mean, I guess first off, you mentioned that you were like, you know, quote unquote, a psycho in terms of analyzing things. I'm the same actually. But did you immediately launch into like analyzing like what happened in the match, or did you just kind of like, you know, take a break and do your normal recovery protocols and then think about it the next day? Or what do you think's best? Or maybe it just depends again on the player.
Yeah, back then I wish I had more video because I would have watched every match I ever played. And we didn't really have video, a little bit in college, but it was grainy and difficult. Now I would be using Swing Vision. I'd be using something and I'd go, hey, I'm watching, you know, whatever. After the match, maybe talk about it with my coach or a friend, go eat, stretch, take care of your body. That night, for sure, I'm watching the match and taking notes and going, oh, interesting. Like I thought I did X, Y, and Z. The video is telling me something different. I thought I was standing over here. I thought this guy hit so many winners. Oh, I've heard that. I do some remote coaching and someone said, oh, I played a little more conservatively, like you said, and the person hit a ton of winners. So I said, okay, let's watch it. Let's go back. And the person hit 12 winners in the match. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, like that's not even enough. That's three games. Not even three games. So being able to go back and watch objectively what happened, I think should be a huge part of anyone's post-match, you know, routine.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It reminded me of like Virginia Tech was like one of the only matches back when I played where they actually recorded the video and I was watching it and it was like really grainy, but it was still like super helpful. But kind of on that vein, Jonathan, what do you encourage students to use? Like, do you have them use stuff like Swing Vision or some other like apps and whatnot to help with the analysis part?
Yeah. So I've been on Swing Vision now for a couple months. I like that a lot. Number one, just because like if you were doing your match, you can list me as a coach and it shows up on my app. So in the past, it was a huge issue with so-and-so got a GoPro, then the file size is too big and they got to email it to me. And it was like most people, they just go, oh, it's too much. I don't want to do it. Yeah. Now they just have to stick the phone on the stick, list me as a coach. And it's like, cool. Now I see your match. Super simple. You get some stats on there, which is nice. Yeah, so Swing Vision to me is just the simplest. And when I coach people remotely, that's the simplest way for them to get me the video. There's tons of different options out there. You could pay more or less or use a GoPro if you want. But as long as you're videoing it, you have a chance to improve. If you never watch yourself, I mean, that is really, really difficult to get a great feel for what you're doing out there.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of a random question, but what's maybe like the toughest match that you ever played, and then like the big lesson or takeaway that you took obviously from that match?
The toughest? You mean like the most yes. challenging, or the like the one where I was like, man, this everything is super difficult, or the closest?
Yeah, no, it's a great clarifying question. I was even trying to figure that out myself. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it can either be like a very difficult match in terms of like ups and downs, or it could be a shellacking where you're, you know, that where some revelation came from that. So I give you the leeway, you know, it can be any of those.
Okay. I'll give you an example of each. How's that?
Perfect. Thank you.
I played national indoors team championships at Duke. So this was junior year. We were in Midtown in Chicago. I was playing two singles and I had to play Benjamin Becker. So yeah. I'm going to say he got up to top 50 in the world, maybe better than that. And I'm playing him at line two, which is hilarious. Like how good is their team that guy can't even play? Yeah. And I lost that guy in about, I was a quick player. So I'm going to give myself that leeway. Like I get a ball and I go. I did not go to the towel. It was probably like 44 minutes. I lost one and two. Mm-hmm. And I learned, I'm like, oh, okay. If my serve doesn't hurt the guy, then I'm going to lose. Like, the rest of my game was not up to par with a guy like that. So most people, my serve could get me high volleys. It could get me short balls. I got a couple free points. This guy was taking full cuts. And I'm like, okay, I got to get the rest of my game going if I want to compete at that level. And when you lose in 45 minutes or less, that's pretty humbling when you're cheering for your teammates and they're still in the first set. Like that's not a great feeling. A more competitive match would be at home. We played Illinois and I played Kevin Anderson. Hilariously, also at line two.
What the hell?
He didn't even play one on his own team, which is a joke. And he beat me six in the third.
Oh,
and I
wow.
played Man. Out of my mind. I played great.
Wow.
And that was a big lesson for me too, because I left and we lost the match pretty significantly. So I wasn't upset for the team and losing the close one. But that's where I learned where, you know what? Like you can lose a match and take positives. So I took a ton of confidence from that match. Man, my serve was great. My pickup volleys were awesome. Like I stressed him out. It was five in the third in the breaker. Like I played an out ball. I remember that very specifically.
In the breaker?
In the breaker, five all. He had a forehand 6 inches out. I'm like, I didn't see it. And like,
shoot.
And I know, ironically, back then people used to call close balls in. That's somehow changed in the last 20 years, but
respect. Yes.
But I left that match and that was like a huge springboard. I'm like, oh my God, I'm just as good as this guy. If we played that match 10 times, I would have won five. This happened to be one of the five that I lost, but I'm moving forward. I'm building on what I did. So that was a big lesson for me, is that I can play with someone like that. I can use a loss as a positive and gain confidence. It's not all about the result. But that line call haunts me to this day.
Yeah, well, I know. Yeah, probably doesn't help too much, but we've all had similar, you know, situations like that. But yeah, that's tough. You remember like the last point? Was it like one of his huge ass serves or what?
Probably. Yeah, I can't remember. all I remember is at five all, he hit that forehand approach. He caught it late.
Yeah.
And I just never saw it land. And everyone in the crowd was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. I didn't see it. You know, like I'm
not. No ump.
So we had an ump, but you call your own lines.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I guess I could have just called it out and seen, but like I was like horrified at getting overruled. You know, so I'm like, oh, I don't want to hook
nice
the guy,
guy.
You know? And so like Yeah, nice guys finished last, man. Lost the match.
Yeah, he's still doing pretty well, my friend. But it's all good though. Very interesting stuff, man. I'm wondering about just like, you know, what you have moving forward, like any particular projects or anything, you know, you want us to be checking out or looking out for.
Yeah. So with the podcast, I've been doing, you know, every 2 weeks trying to do interviews. I'm going to start supplementing that in between on that week off. I'm just going to start doing, I do Instagram videos where I kind of talk about a concept, but you're trying to rush it in there, right? Like heaven forbid on Instagram, you do a video more than like 30 seconds and everyone's already like,
swipe.
Yeah. So I'm going to do like little 5 to 10 minute episodes, just something that's helpful. You know, on the way to your match, you could listen to it and go, oh, interesting. Like nice take on simple targets or a nice take on being positive. So, something simple that you could apply to your game. And then, yeah, this year, one thing I'm doing, and like I said, I've kind of grown to love coaching adults, is doing a lot more adult camps. So we're doing one in Charleston. It's during the Charleston Open, which is, I think, March 31st. And then that first week of April. So I already did, I'm doing that camp. I'll be doing a bunch of camps for adults throughout the summer, kind of mid spring and summer, like come in for 2-3 days. I'm lucky that Charleston's such a nice place that people, you know, aren't afraid to go there anyway. So some things like that. Yeah. And then still just, you know, my normal on court, you know, coaching juniors, coaching some adults in the area, coaching some people remotely. But at the end of the day, I love coaching and I love learning. So I'll always be on the court to some extent. And then the podcast is just kind of an extension of that.
Awesome, man. Lucky to have you in the tennis world. Do you have any links or anything like regarding like that camp and whatnot? Like, do people like sign up online or is like, what are they?
So one thing, so I did a reel for that camp, which is awesome. I did a reel for that camp and I had 800 people respond that day.
Oh, I saw that camp. Yeah, I saw that. I was like, wow, this is incredible. Like,
yeah,
it was a super lot of, how's he going to fit everyone?
Yeah, well, no, it was for 16 people and that thing filled up quickly. So I'm currently in the process. I'll be messaging all those people again and letting them know kind of when I finalize dates. I'm trying to find dates. One thing I didn't even think of was that March 31st is Easter. So I had about 50 people who were like dying to sign up and they said, oh, I can't do it. This year's Easter, but next year, like, pencil me in, like I'm in that. So I'm going to try to find what dates work in the summer. I actually have to look at the holiday schedule, which, you know, I never would pay attention to something like that, but now I have to. So I'm still finalizing the dates. So there's no official link or anything, but if people follow my Instagram, I will definitely be promoting those dates like crazy and messaging people. And, you know, they can feel free to email me. I have my email on my Instagram page, on my Baseline Intelligence bio. It's all there. So they could reach out anyway. I have a newsletter that I also advertise on. It's on Substack. I can give you a link to that at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Once I finalize those dates, I'm excited. You know, you get a bunch of, you know, 12 to 16 adults who are all super motivated. They're all really cool. They all love the game. Some cool little perks that we have from the brands that I work with, New Balance, Yonex, Fiori. So
cool.
The camps will be cool. And yeah, once I get those dates, would love to have people come out.
Yeah, definitely. Those, I mean, as you've already experienced, like that, I also love working with adults. They're like so nice and so passionate, and it's beautiful. So yeah, sounds like you need to definitely do more camps, man, because this fill up pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. And then the 5 to 10 minute videos that you mentioned that people can like listen to on their way to matches and whenever, obviously, was that on IG or like a different platform?
So I'm going to be doing that starting in January. So right now I've still been doing the kind of the every 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got Rajiv coming out and then I'll do like a year end following your footsteps, a year end review. And then starting in January, of course, I'll start with Pagula again. She starts every season. She's the GOAT. And then that second week of January, the second Monday is when I'll release those shorts and it'll just be on my normal podcast platform.
Your podcast. Okay, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
gotcha. So it'll just be like a very short me talking to the mic, like I've heard you done sometimes, but just a really short, digestible concept that I can explain with a little more detail and clarity than I could just trying to, I mean, jamming a thought into 30 seconds on Instagram is so difficult. It really is. And I've heard people say that attention spans aren't shorter. It's just the standard for content quality is higher, which I agree with, because the guy said, hey, you know, people will binge 10 straight hours of Netflix. Like, they have no problem focusing for 10 hours, but it's a pretty high bar, man. Like if I'm talking about your forehand for 40 seconds, you've probably already checked out. So on the podcast, I'll be able to elaborate a little more and go into more detail.
Nice, man. I forgot. Do you do YouTube right now as well? Or
I don't. Some people have mentioned it. It's so much with, you know, recording the episode, editing a podcast episode, putting out the Instagram, being on court, coaching people remotely. I got to make sure my little French bulldog gets enough love and attention. Like YouTube's just one more thing that I'd have to worry about. So right now I'm not on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah. Pick and choose. Yeah,
exactly.
You don't want life to be rough for your dog. Sorry. The horrible pun.
Yeah.
I'm full of them. I'm full of them. Sweet, man. Well, really enjoyed chatting with you. I want to give you, you know, a decent amount of time to still get to the courts, but, you know, as I always ask, just wondering if there's any particular piece of advice that you want to get, like, leave us with, I guess, to help us improve our game, can be about any particular aspect of tennis.
Oh, great question. I'm going to do what so many people do on my podcast and reiterate something I've already said, but the expectation management part of your game is massive, because you will always leave unhappy. If you're a 4-0, but your best day you played like a 4-5 and that's what you expect, then the other 100 days you play in the year, you are pissed and you think you suck and you think something is wrong. And it's okay to realize, like, where you are. Hey, I'm just a 4-0, or hey, I'm just a 3-0 right now. I'm working to become a 3-5, but I am not a 3-5 yet. And so if I play like a 3-0, that is okay today, as long as I gave my all. So yeah, keeping your expectations in check about your own level, keeping your expectations in check about the tactics you're using and how often they should work, and then keeping your expectations in check for how long it takes to improve. It's a big thing. So I find you'll be happier. And if you're happier, you will try harder and try more consistently, and then you will actually improve.
That's huge. That's huge. I definitely know so many people who have that expectation. And yeah, I try to tell people, like, you know, let's say, like, you go on vacation or whatever, and then you come back to the court. Like, I've seen people do that and they're like getting so pissed that they're missing. I'm like, dude, I mean, you shouldn't expect to play like so amazing and you haven't played for weeks.
You know, the funny thing I find is, and this happens to me in golf all the time, if I take a long break and I come back, I'm just happy to be on the court or on the golf course. And so you actually play pretty well. Then the second day is when you really mess it up. Because now you have expectations. Oh, wow, I played well yesterday. But the reality is you haven't been playing for a month and you're rusty. And now you match that with expectations. And the second day always blows. So pay attention to that out there. The first day you're loose as a goose, and you can use that concept and go, man, I can just come out with no expectations every day. Yeah. It's a lot easier to play that way.
Yeah. Great point. By the way, before I let you go, I mean, you seem like a very learned fellow. Are you reading any good books lately or anything? No,
I'm the worst. I'm ripping on everyone for attention span, but like sitting through a whole book is tough. Like, I'm always on YouTube, basically watching shorts. The episode I just released, Dr. John Finn, he wrote the book, The Habit Mechanic.
Yeah.
So I'm learning about his stuff. Sweet. I have not read the book yet. I have read parts of the book. I have watched his videos explaining the parts of the book that like are really interesting to me.
Yeah.
But I would highly, you know, if people haven't listened to that episode, it's a great episode. The information is super cool. I mean, how your brain runs your body. So you better know how your brain works and how it's operating on autopilot. But I've been in his information quite a bit. I can't technically say I've been reading the book though.
It counts, man. He's still supporting. Actually, would you do audiobooks? Because like Spotify, I just learned for whatever reason, like a few weeks ago, they said, oh, you get like, it was either like 15 hours or 8 hours of like audiobook listening. So
can you watch, you ever do that? Can you watch the, like, it's just in your ear, right? Like there's no YouTube. Like for some reason, I need that visual too. I like,
visual learning.
When I just hear someone talking for too long. especially in a book, not a podcast, because a podcast is conversational, but in the book, I just get bored. Like if you're just giving me information, but it's kind of monotonous, I'm just like, I lost it. I forgot what you said 2 minutes ago.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I can't do it.
No, I feel, it's, everyone learns differently. So visual learner is Jonathan.
Yep.
Good stuff, man. Well, hey, you know, again, thanks for all the great work you're doing, loving the podcast and, you know, all your content, and just really appreciate you, you know, being a great ambassador for the tennis community, and looking forward to the next one. I'll make sure that it's much less than a year for us to get back together.
Yeah, man, you got to set it like a 6-month alarm instead of the 12 month. But yeah, happy to be on here. Love talking tennis with you. Love all the information you share. I still listen to your podcast all the time. Honor to be here, man.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Take care. All right. I really hope that you enjoyed this interview with Coach Jonathan Stokey. It was great to have him on the show, and I look forward to him coming on next time as well. If you did get value and learn from this show today, then I really would appreciate it if you would leave a review for the Tennis Files podcast. You can do that at tennisfiles.com/Apple Podcasts with an S at the end. Can definitely leave a review on any platform that you use to listen to the show, but we just find that Apple Podcasts is the biggest mover of the show in terms of the visibility and rankings and whatnot. And the main thing for me is that it just seems to be the best mover of the show, and you know, more people see it on that platform than any other. So reviews on there are a bit more powerful, but definitely thank you for any feedback you leave for me in any form. Me and the team appreciate it. So I also want to leave you with a quote, as I do at the end of every show, and this one is by Fitzhugh Dodson. And Fitzhugh said, "Without goals and plans to reach them, you are like a ship that has set sail with no destination." I remember my coach in college, Keith Purrier, saying that as well. So shout out to Keith, who's at Naval Academy right now, but with the women's program. But yeah, with that, thanks again for listening to the show. Really appreciate it. And I've got some fun and informative interviews and shows down the pike coming forth for you. So with that, I hope you have a great rest of your week. Keep improving your tennis game, and I'll see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files Podcast. This is your host, Mir Bhanaranshad, signing out.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files Podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.